Dr. Marla Morkin is a doctor, head of market development at Celyn, and hosts the Royal Society of Medicine's Digital Health podcast. She's been featured on Forbes 30 Under 30 and Vogue UK's Top 10 Rising Female Stars. Impressive, considering she graduated from medical school just 2 years ago. We talk about persistence, chasing failure, leaving medicine, and what it's like as a woman in health tech. I hope you enjoy. So Marla, could you tell me a little bit about your story, so how you got to where you are today?
Hi, thanks so much for having me on. I mean, this is the age-old question. I always get nervous that you're going to ask me this, but I probably should have been prepared. But yeah, I mean, hi, I'm Marla, everyone. And I train. I'm a qualified doctor, and I quite swiftly moved out of clinical medicine and work full-time now in an early-stage health tech startup alongside hosting the Royal Society of Medicine's Digital Health podcast, and I hold a few academic roles as well, and I sit on the editorial board of the International Journal of Digital Health. So a few fun things, and I'm really excited to talk to you. Yeah.
Can you fill me in on the story from maybe the start of medical school to now? Like, at each step, how did you actually get to where you are?
I think I can probably speak for quite a few med students, is that it's a long time and a lot of structure and a lot of time within that structured time where you can fill it with anything. And so everyone goes off, they find their sports, they find their hobbies, they find their activities. And I knew that I really enjoy technology. But when I started med school, there wasn't really much going on with healthcare and technology. It was seen as not as glamorous and not as exciting as it kind of is now. And so I started actually working in other tech companies. I was working in startups that were doing like viral video management and things like that. And this was in like internships and summers, and any breaks I had, I would just try and do some type of internship somewhere, not just because I wanted to learn, but because I needed to earn money. And I would just rather work in a startup than I don't know, the local pub. So I did different internships, and in year two I worked at Touch Surgery, where I did some surgical simulation validation and joined their sales team as well. The summer after that, I did a short time at Zesty, a short time at DemDx as well, working on different projects across the board. And then went to Unilever. At Unilever, I was in their data analytics team, looking at basically how different consumers were, like across all of their brands at Unilever, we could use their Google Analytics tools and we could actually just simply see how they were spending their money. But here's the interesting thing, you could pair up what the different brands were doing, and then you could see on a wider market, like how all the shampoo buyers were buying. Then I did my 3 months at the European Space Agency, and that was part of my BSc project. So I was doing global health, and whilst I was there, I was trying to relate how taking healthy people into unhealthy situations, so mirroring what we do with refugees, where we take them into a situation which is high stress, they're not eating as well, they're not exercising as well. It's almost the same as what we're doing with astronauts. They are put into a different situation. What does the effect on the human body have? And I was at the Harvest Digital Health Accelerator as well for a bit of time, and the Malawi eHealth research. So there was kind of what I was doing over med school. At the same time, I was learning how to build content. So, and that kind of led me to the RSM's Royal Society of Medicine's Digital Health podcast. So I did some work for The Guardian. I wrote some articles with the Microsoft Health blogging team. I blogged officially for Imperial for the whole 6 years. And it was like slowly learning the value of content production and what that can mean for building your own personal profile as well. So that's kind of what I was up to.
So within your story, you've interned as a digital health researcher at Harvard, at The Guardian. You've clearly got a formula that works for you. So what is that formula?
Well, how to get different internships, is that what the question is? Persistence, knowing what your story is and knowing what you want, and then just going and getting it. I'm saying all the things that I did do, but it's not talking through all the hundreds of rejections I got, right? Like the And this is something that is really stark, is that like resilience is taught a lot at med school. Every single time they teach you, you need to know what resilience is. However, they don't give you many options to fail at med school. And failure is seen as something that is actually they shelter you from failure quite a lot. And actually, I think in quite a damaging way. If you don't actively seek opportunities to fail, you won't build that resilience. And so the only way that you can get these internships, yeah, sure, you need a CV and sure, you need to have a LinkedIn and all of these other things. But the main thing is just having grit to, when someone says no, being able to either reply back and say, oh, you know, not like why, but, you know, like a follow up of some sort. But or having the patience to pick yourself up and try another email address. And I think that that is something that should be more widely taught.
So is the formula to love and chase failure?
Yeah. Yeah. Be addicted to failure. And that's like, honestly, there's one piece of advice I could give is like, if you go out actively seeking to fail, failure doesn't become a disappointment. It becomes a learning experience. So that's something we should all be striving for, right? Every single day, we should be looking for ways to fail so that we can learn what we don't know, so that we can grow, so that we can improve. If you're not failing once a day, like, what are you doing, right? And then the success becomes even that more important, because success goes outside your safety net and you start building success in areas that you didn't even know was imaginable, right? You're taking part in opportunities that, I mean, like, it's crazy when I think back at, if, like, 6 years ago, I never thought I'd be at the European Space Agency, for example. But now I look back on it and it feels really natural and part of my path, because I did coordinate it to try and get there, if you see what I mean.
Do any particular examples come to mind of times you failed and then what you learned from that?
Oh, yeah. There are so many. I mean, the obvious one is when you don't get the email replies and then you're just like, such a waste of time, right? But it's not, it's fine, keep going. But there was one time where for year four of medical school, you apply for what project you want to do, right? And I know that you spent some time at Imperial as well, so you kind of know the gist of it. You have to, back when I was there, you had to do a 3-month stint somewhere, and that was partaking research for a 10-week stint, right? I had applied to go to Japan, and that was part of the medical school program. And I had got down, I think, to like the final six, and three people go. It was something like that, right? But there was a 1 in 2 chance by the time that I was at interview process that I would get the place. I worked so hard. I did practice interviews. I tailored my specification, like everything you could think of. I tried my hardest. And at this point, I had been working my butt off, right, to try and get as many internships and be well-rounded and all of these different things. So, and I had studied Japanese at school, so I was like, please, right, like all of these things. And anyway, I went into the interview and I thought it went really well, and I didn't get it. I didn't get the place, and I was really, really, really upset. And it felt like I'd done, you know, weeks of work, and I know now I look back and I'm like, oh, it's just the thing I didn't get, right? But at the time, it's so important to you, and it's almost crushing. You feel like your whole worth is riding on someone else telling you yes. And then you question your own worth after that once you've not got that. You're like, but I thought that I was good enough, so am I not? And then at that point, it spirals. And I remember I got the email when I was on placement, and I was at one of the hospital placements on firms. And I looked at my phone and I read the email, and I was crying so much. I couldn't stop crying. I was like in the locker room, and it was so awkward. And I was just crying so much. And I think it took me about half an hour to pull myself together. I was like, couldn't do anything else. I think I had to like Uber home. Like, I couldn't talk to anyone. I didn't even want to tell anyone that I didn't get it. I was just so embarrassed. And then my friends and my partner and my parents, it's about surrounding yourself with people, right, that will help you get that resilience and help you stand up again, and all of these things that I know you've talked about on your other podcasts about having that good support network, right? That was when they said to me, was that, you know, like, that's just one opportunity, try and again for another one, right? And that was when I got the European Space Agency. And if I hadn't have got that rejection, and if I hadn't have kept going, I wouldn't have got my placement in Germany at the EAC. I just wouldn't have done it. So yeah, but I didn't know that at the time. I was horrible. It was in such a bad place.
One of the things I think you do really well is personal branding. And I wanted to ask if you have any specific ways you approach that, or any specific advice or strategies that you use to do that well.
Thank you. First of all, that's really, really kind of you. I think you do personal branding really well, so I would ask you the same question. I think if you talk to anyone that's accidentally created a brand, they will tell you that they'd rather have put it under their name. And I think that that is something that we're seeing, well, not everyone, right? But I'm generalizing here. But I think it's something that you need to know right now, the power of your own name. And putting things under your own name, making sure that people know who you are, making sure that people know what work you're doing is really important, and something that we're just not taught in medical school. And at university in general, if you don't create your own worth, someone else will define that for you. And I'll say it one more time, because it's so important, right? If you don't create who you are, that level of that worth, and knowing what skill set you can provide, and for, you know, what price really, then someone else will give you that price. Someone else will set who you are. Someone else will tell you what bucket you're going to fit into. And someone else will give you that job that maybe you don't really want. And then you'll end up in a situation where maybe you've gone down a path that you didn't really want to be down. So it's really important that, you know, almost on a weekly basis, you're stopping, whether it's through meditation, mindfulness, something, and you're kind of touching base with what your values are. And reminding yourself, you know, am I on track? Am I doing things that are aligned with who I am? And all of these things. So the personal branding stuff is so important because of that, though, which is, if you know fundamentally who you are and who you want to be, it's really easy to create your own personal brand around it. If you're confused about it, it's really difficult. It's really difficult. So before you even start thinking about personal branding, you need to start thinking about what type of things do you enjoy? Who do you want to be known for, et cetera, et cetera. And then it's all about taking as many opportunities as you can to create that brand. And if it's content, like you yourself do, you know, like it's like blogging wherever you can, offering your skill set up to startups, offering it up to big companies, just saying that you'll do a blog for them, you know, pitching articles to companies. If it's something else, like if it's tech stuff and you want to get, like, you want to be the best, I don't know, UX designer, then you need to be creating that portfolio. You need to be gunning for opportunities where you can showcase that, and you need to be creating that.
So once you've discovered or decided, and you've gone out and you've gone for opportunities and you've worked out where you want to be, do you have any practical steps on starting to create a personal brand?
It's really tricky because I'm not a marketing expert. I just know what worked for me, and it took a lot of time for it to kind of land somewhere. But I would just say, like, the practical steps would be, you need to start somewhere. Stop worrying about the big picture, stop worrying about it. You need to start thinking about, like, really strategically. So break it up into almost like you would in a company, right? Like your quarters of the year. Break it up onto a monthly basis. Like, what do you want to have achieved at the end of this month that you haven't done last month? Like, is it writing one blog post for one company? Great, go and do that, right? If it is that you want to, I don't know, be on a podcast, go pitch yourself, like, and go. And like, if you want to pitch yourself to 20 podcasts, if you want to be able to secure an internship or a 3-week placement for your holiday, break it down into sizable chunks, because then once you've got that, then you can start creating that portfolio of who you are. And then you can create your website, you can create, you know, your Instagram accounts, your Twitter, your TikTok, whatever it is you want your channel as, but you need something to go on there. And you need that content to start you off.
So somewhere along your journey, you decided that clinical medicine wasn't the path to go down. And I wanted to know what the decision-making process behind that was. And now, looking back, or even looking currently, because it's not like you can never come back, was that the right decision for you?
It's a good question. And I guess I, like, to answer it in reverse, I probably will never know if it was the right decision. I just won't. It was the right decision at the time. The decision-making process for me was, I don't know, I say this quite differently on and every time someone asks me that question, I think about it more and more, and hindsight is obviously the easiest thing to look back on this with, right? Like, it's much easier to see it. Clinical medicine becomes a way of life, and you take on that persona of being a doctor. That is who you are. Firms, you know, the ward rounds, the curtains, the drawing, you know, like the writing in the notes, the BMA, like everything, like that is all part of who you are. And it's like, it becomes who you are. It wasn't a decision as to, do I want to do this job or not? Like other people face in different industries, it became a decision of, do I want to, like, it's almost like change who I am, right? Because it is that big of a decision when you leave medicine. You have invested so much time into becoming a doctor, and it is it's a new language, it's a new thing, and you are a new person. To quit is like, you know, sunk cost. It's like, it's a lot to quit. I had to take a step back and I had to think of it like a job. And I think that was one of the hardest things to do, because again, you're not taught how to do this. This is my job. And as a job, is it making me happy? Is it giving me the ability to do the things I want to do for a job? And the way I always break it down is I say that there are like five pillars in life. You've got friends, family. This is my pillars, by the way. Friends, family, relationships, hobbies, extracurriculars, and work. That fifth one, work, became all of them. So I was cancelling on my family because, like, I was working. I wasn't able to look after them when they got ill properly. When my friends and I couldn't get together, like, it's impossible. We were all working different shifts. And then, like, my friends that were non-medics is really hard. Then... And everyone that I was friends with was pretty much a doctor, right? It's hard when you're trying to do like long distance relationships or like anything with, you know, going on date nights or planning holidays. It's really hard. And then your hobbies become everything to do with work as well when you're a doctor. Like, it's bizarre. Like, you, like, you're like excited to do a hobby, which is like writing a paper. That's like, that's not a hobby, that's work, but they make you feel like it's a hobby. And, you know, like all of these things started filtering into it. And I realized that, like, I was working to work. That's what I was doing. I was going to work to carry on working when I got back. And I was letting it take over my life. And so I need to take a step back and say, actually, if I want everything else in my life to look like it is, this career is not going to allow me that choice. And that was something that was really personal, but I knew what I wanted from the others. And I knew the type of lifestyle I wanted. And I take my hat off to everyone that does clinical medicine. I think it's fantastic. But for me, it was just, one, it was the job. I really just wanted to do health tech. But two, I needed at that point in my life, I needed to be able to give more to my other pillars.
In the world of health tech, where does being or having got up to the level of an F1 sit? Is it the case that if you got to the next level, say a reg or a consultant, that you'd be in a much more advantageous position? Or is it that in some industries or some industries it's helpful? Where does that sit with you now?
I guess you guys are the judge of it, not me. it really depends what role you want. That's it. That's all I can say, right? It's a job. If you want to be chief medical officer, then yeah, you should probably still be working as a doctor. to be a chief medical officer in a startup, you probably need to still be practicing clinically. I was able to get a job, and I think that most people can, because you do have pretty much one or two degrees once you've finished, and then you can apply for a normal grad scheme. You can apply for a job at a startup. You will get it, like most of the time you will get a job. It will be hard. It took me a few months to find a permanent role that I was really happy with. And I was doing lots of ad hoc work in between. I actually think it took me about 5-6 months before I went full time. So like, it does take time, but you can do it. It's that resilience again. If you want to leave after red, you'll have a bit more clinical experience, but you'll have less of the 20s, right? So it depends. And I hate playing this card, right? But like, if you need to be putting in as much time in your personal life planning as you are in your professional life. You just must. If you can have a 5-year plan for your professional life, you need to have one for your personal life as well. And I knew personally, if I carried on and I like became a qualified GP or something, and then I wanted to quit, I'd have to start again from scratch, because you do, if you change careers, you have to start again from the bottom, scrape your way up again. And I'd be in my 30s and I didn't want to. That was just a personal choice. I knew I wanted to do it, so I'd rather do it now. Whilst I can give the time and the energy and I can work stupid hours and I can, you know, like literally give myself to a job, I want to do it now when I'm in my 20s. I don't have any kids. I don't have any like people that are reliant. You see, all of these other things came into play. And because I had mapped out my personal life and my professional life, I knew that I needed to do it now because I wanted to. 20s is the time for taking risks. That is it. 20s is the time. Well, you can take risks anytime, but do it in your 20s. Why not?
To me, at least, the pros of leaving clinical medicine and doing cool stuff like yourself in the startup world and with other projects as well, the pros are quite obvious. But have there been any cons, and maybe any cons that have surprised you of leaving a stable clinical job?
No. I wanted to help a bit more in the pandemic. But you can in health tech anyway, so that was fine. No, there haven't been any cons. You know, I have my weekends. I know when I can take annual leave. It's all these simple things, right? Like, I understand money a lot better now. I understand my pension. You look for all of these other things because you're just learning about it. I have time in the evenings to have a bottle of wine, go out for after work drinks. My lifestyle is it's better than it was as a junior doc. I know that it's different for everyone, right? But like, I suppose the cons are is that like you're not in the NHS, which is fundamentally like the greatest place in the world to work. Like, it is fantastic. It's one of the best things that's ever come out of the UK, and it's just amazing. And it's it, you know. And I don't get a vaccine. Is that a con? Like, I don't know if I can. Like, there are a few things, like, I'm making them up now. I don't really have many cons. I love, and you know what? Here's the thing. It was a rut. I came out of a rut when I was in clinical medicine. I thought it was the thing I had to do, because you have what your dreams are, which society has told you, and then you actually have your actual dreams, right? And I thought that was my dream. I did think it was like there, and I got there, and I got to this pinnacle of, you know, I'm a qualified doctor, I'm working, I have a job, I have great friends and all of these things, and I was just deeply unhappy. And so I've now got to a place where I feel I'm really, really happy with where I am. I have a job that I love. I really, really love it. I have hobbies and the podcast, and I love doing those things. I would love to see my family and friends more, but it's a pandemic. But like, you know, they're such healthy people around me, and I've cut the toxic people out. And so I feel like if I was to like rate where I am, I'm so like, and I say this, I'm really proud of myself for getting here, because it is such a difficult choice to make the choice for yourself. It's so selfish. It feels really selfish to do it, and to be able to power through and be like, no, like keep going down what you want to do, even if it's difficult. Like, I'm proud of myself for doing it. And I hope that other people that have made decisions similar are also proud of themselves for going and doing what makes them happy.
Have there been any books or resources that you'd recommend looking into?
Yeah, I mean, most of the books I read are like female empowerment and women in the workplace and books like that. Like, I learned the greatest amount from Melinda Gates's book. I think that she wrote fantastically about how if you lift, fundamentally, if you invest in women's health and invest in women's education, invest in women in general, you lift up the entire family, and you can really do wonders for a society. I think that is, that's taught me some of the basics I know about global health and public health, and I really value that book. The other one is I read Lean In, and then I very quickly read Unfinished Business, which is always like the follow-on book, but it's like there's more to be said here. And actually knowing that as a, you know, as someone in the workplace that, and it's actually the same in health tech as well, in a place where it feels uncomfortable to be there, maybe it's not the ideal work environment for you, for example, if you're a woman and it's hard to quit early because you need to go pick up your kids, right? That's not your fault. It's the workplace's fault. And knowing how you can actually impact change to make it more sustainable as a workplace for not just you, but others around you, I think that's really important.
What are the specific challenges of health tech as a woman that you've experienced or that you've seen?
I think something is that, like, there's something in the game of mentorship here. I don't know how to say this in like a PC way, right? But like, one of the things I've realized is that people like to give you advice unsolicited, right? A lot of the time. But knowing that you can stand your ground, and especially in health tech, and be like, no, I do understand this concept, is really important. Sometimes people confuse mentorship for unsolicited advice, right? They think that they're mentoring you and helping you through your problems and questions, but actually it's patronizing. And so for me, I found one of the challenges is that, like, perhaps maybe it's because I'm a woman, maybe it's because it just in general it's the ecosystem, maybe it's because I you know, I'm from a ethnic minority background, like all of these different things come into play. But I do find that sometimes advice is given in a patronizing way. And so making sure that the ecosystem is aware that we have diverse talent that is at the forefront of the space is really important, because then when you have people up at the top that can speak like you, that talk like you, that, you know, that all of these different things, then it allows for people to move upwards and not be stuck in like middle management almost, you know what I mean? I think I honestly think the biggest thing is we need more women who are in senior health tech leadership positions to be actively encouraging mentorship in the correct way. And we need lessons into what mentorship in health tech should actually look like.
Is it harder when you look at health tech and then it's, I mean, as you've kind of mentioned, that you don't see people that look like you in very senior positions? I guess I'm asking this as a brown guy who knows tons and tons and tons of academics and CEOs and people in policy who look just like me. Does that make things more difficult for people to enter?
Oh yeah, 100%. It feels awkward to say, right? But like, when you watch television and you don't see someone that looks like you playing the main roles, it's hard enough, right? But when you look in your workplace and you can't relate to people that are in leadership positions, you can't empathize with the way that they work, you know, you don't have the same thoughts as them, the same feelings as them, they can't mentor you in the right way. If you can't get active mentorship because of it, not only is it not inspiring that you can reach those goals, but also you don't get to learn the skills that you need that are really personalized to you to get up to the top. So having mentors that look like yourself are really important. Also having mentors that don't look like yourself that are willing to understand what they don't know to fill in those gaps as well. I've got the most fantastic set of mentors that are around me, right? But I wish every day that we had more, you know, a more diverse workforce sitting at the top of health tech. And right now, I mean, we were chatting about it briefly offline, is that you kind of have people that have got to the top of health tech, but they don't really know how they've got there. They've kind of had a bit of interest in technology and a bit of interest in healthcare, and they've kind of ended up there. And what we're going to see in the next few years, I hope, is a much more structured career path. We're going to see a lot more people going into the space. We're going to see a lot more talent, a lot more strictness almost on how we mentor people, how we get people up about diversity quotas, about like all of these things. And I think we're starting to get there, but it's really important that we're encouraging it from the start.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. You can find all my links by going to bigpicturemedicine.co.uk. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, then please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you.